Yoo-hoo! Melting me down like a piece of gold. I've been bought and I've been sold. Feeling not so special now.
Hey, welcome back to Danny on Everything. I am your host, Danny Bedrosian, here back at the studio, back at Moose Magnificat Radio, here with my dear friend Carl Cerny, here with the Cerny family. So glad to be back in town after 107 days on the road with my day job as the keyboard player for George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. It was a fantastic tour. According to George's words himself, one of the best, which I take to heart. It's a really wonderful thing to hear such great inspiring things from such an amazing person who we hope to have on the show someday as well. This is our fifth ever episode, and I'm going to be segmenting this one for the first time into a couple of different interview/segments today. The first of which I'm so proud to say that it's the 20th anniversary of my older band, Sweet Mother Child, which was a New England-based funk band that I had back in the 90s and early 2000s before moving to Tallahassee, before joining P-Funk, when I was but a youngster wanting to be the keyboard player for P-Funk. This was the closest I could get to it, so to speak. And Sweet Mother Child was a wonderful, wonderful band. I consider it a band of my brothers and sisters, true family members, people who grew up alongside me or nearby me in the southern New Hampshire, northern Massachusetts, Merrimack River Valley region. I went to college at UNH with a lot of these individuals as well, but we started it actually when I was in high school. And it was, like I said, just a wonderful, wonderful thing. The band ran from 1998 to 2004, the last year of which I was actually no longer a member. I left the group to two other senior members to take on and to push on as I went on to join Parliament Funkadelic. But 6 years, six albums, about 100-something shows. And it really was the beginning of me learning how to book my own shows, produce my own albums, compose more, arrange horns and strings and things I had never really done before. And so it was really an amazing, amazing experience and really almost a lifetime of experiences. When the band started in 1998, our first show was April 10th or April 11th of 1998, and so this really truly is the 20th anniversary of Sweet Mother Child, or SMC as we used to call it. Today, we're going to be playing some of those songs from the old Sweet Mother Child discography and discussing a little bit about this band that started out as a simple four-piece and grew into an 18-piece conglomerate of musicians and crazoids and singers and freaks. And it really was a sight to behold. And I'm not saying that because I was in the band. It truly was a sight to behold. So really, really proud to have been in charge of this merry band of crazy people who I love so dearly and will forever love so dearly. And a lot of times we all still get to get together and hang out, those of us who still see each other, and some of us are still in the music business, myself obviously, and some others. And we're going to speak to actually one of my fellow band members from Sweet Mother Child today, John Deming. We're going to be speaking to him via the phone from New York City. And it's going to be a great interview talking about some of his memories of the band and talking about some of the projects he's working on now, because he himself is actually a brilliant, brilliant human being. And then after that, we're going to play some songs. We're going to talk a little more. And we're going to be debuting a brand new segment that I hope will be a repeat segment called Sith and Synth with my dear friend Travis Thigpen. We're going to be discussing Star Wars lore. And up under everything, I'll be playing on my trademark Novation Base Station 2 which is a synthesizer which I use quite heavily in my music, and the sounds themselves are actually created by me on this particular keyboard specifically. So we're going to be doing all of that fun stuff, and just to get everybody into the Sweet Mother Child mode, we're going to be playing two of the older Sweet Mother Child songs from the second and third albums respectively. The first of which is called Marble Maker, from the Soul Servant album, 1999, written by myself and guitarist Josh Barabo, featuring Chris Monty on the drums, Troy Normandin on the bass, Josh Barabo and Mark Munoz on the guitars, myself on the organ, and myself and my sister Elise Moonchild Bedrosian on vocals. The second song, Is It Glee, is from our third Sweet Mother Child album, also released later in 1999, called Who Is Mr. Groovy Tunes. And it features, again, Chris Monty on drums, Troy Normandin on bass, Mark Munoz and Josh Barabo again on guitars, myself on vocals, Josh Barabo on backup vocals, my sister Elise Bedrosian on keyboards, and the horn section at the time that we had Adam Trull on trumpet, Larry Nguyen on trombone, and Steve Casey on trumpet. And I think I also play melodica on that song. So we're going to listen to those two first, Marble Maker and Is It Glee, both by Sweet Mother Child, celebrating the 20th anniversary of Sweet Mother Child. This is Danny on Everything.
Prevention. He lost his marbles.
Okay, we're back. Danny on everything. We just heard Marble Maker and Is It Glee, both by Sweet Mother Child, my old band, and we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the band's formation and first show. And I am so honored and proud and privileged and happy to have someone who I consider a true brother, someone who I've known for a very long time, Mr. John Deming, who was one of the guitar players for the band. John is a poet and professor living in New York City. His first book of poems, Headline News, has just been released by the Brooklyn-based publisher Indolent Books. He teaches at LIM College and curates KGB Monday Night Poetry in the East Village. He's been a lifelong musician, always working on some project or another. And he's also the editor-in-chief of Cold Front magazine. John, thank you so much for being on the show. So, John, you were, as I know, but for the people that are listening, you were a guitar player for Sweet Mother Child for several years. Tell me what you knew about Sweet Mother Child before you were in the band. What it was to you?
Well, I encountered Sweet Mother Child because Josh Baraba, one of the other guitar players, was somebody I went to high school with. We weren't exactly sort of friends at that point, but when you're learning how to play music in high school, you're sort of looking to absorb everything, and most bands with high school kids in them, when they did funk, even if the musicians had ability, it would always be this kind of saccharine, kind of watered down covers of Jungle Boogie and so forth. I mean, which is fine, but it seems to me Danny was making concept albums that musicians would wear these outlandish kind of costumes and so forth. The music was really original, and it introduced me and many others who didn't know better to funk as a sort of philosophical concept. I think it it effectively was like, even before I sort of joined the band, I was sort of part of this energy that was going on where there was Sweet Mother Child was sort of effectively building like a cult on this idea of the one, making it more or less like a sleeper cell of the sort of P-funk religion. And I guess it sort of came from that, and I just liked going to the shows because it really, New Hampshire band, there just wasn't anything remotely like it, and we just kind of knew, me and some of my friends at the time, that this was just different,
That's so, really, really interesting.
And so it started with that, going to shows, and then everything else. We got to know you guys, and, you know, it all went down from there.
Nice. I remember seeing you at some shows, you know, when we were much younger, and thinking, oh, these kids are really into us. This is, like, really cool. Little would I realize that you'd soon be in the ranks of the band itself. And
yeah, no, exactly. That was exciting for everybody. Like, it was a sort of, it just, like, you know, as I was saying, I don't know how much anybody knows about bands from New Hampshire at the time, but there was a lot of really bad sort of kind of rap rock music going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, and the only kind of bands that actually had kind of ability were sort of doing, like, that kind of thing. And, yeah, to us, Sweet Mother Child was just, you know, it was cartoonish and ridiculous and crazy, and I didn't even really know all that much about P-Funk at the time. And, yeah, it was exciting. We just kind of knew that it was something special, and that's where the energy was. So.
That's fantastic. Now, do you remember what year it was when you joined?
I believe it was 1999, that Sean and Carmichael and I joined up, and then kind of a few other guys came just after that, because I graduated from high school in 2000, which, good Lord, is almost 20 years, and so it was just around that time, and then went off to college, you know.
I actually remember calling you from my dorm room in college, and even though we were 1 year apart, at that cusp period, that transitional period when two of the members were leaving, the bass player and the guitar player, one of the guitar players, Mark Munoz and Troy Normandin, left their first time leaving. And they were like 3 or 4 years older than me. And you and Sean and a lot of the other guys that were coming in were about a year younger than me. And even though that doesn't makes no difference now, at the time it made a difference because you guys were in high school and I was in college. And
yeah, well, first of all, don't make me picture you in that dorm room because...
Right. So I remember calling you from the dorm room, and I remember Josh and myself fighting over, you know, like, Josh, I think Josh got Carmichael and I got you, even though you guys both went to school with Josh. I think it was kind of how we put it.
Yeah, no, it was, because I had contacted you. I remember you put some email or something out that you were looking at for, like, a brief period at doing, like, some sort of Sweet Mother Child offshoot band. And to me, it was like, it's just like, you know, you kind of know when you see the people that you want to be working with, and if there's any kind of in, you sort of take it. You and I started a dialogue that way.
Yeah.
The guitar playing slot opened up, and yeah, I remember that. That's how it went down. Where I think, yeah, Sean came by way of Josh.
Right. Now, how was it for you, John, being in Sweet Mother Child? And you can answer this in any kind of way you want, physical, yeah, psychological, whatever. But what was it like for you being a member of this this crazy group of individuals, which I had said in an earlier segment was pretty large at various times? What was it like being in this group?
I'm really grateful because I think I had an experience that most people don't get. You know, the 15 or 20 or whatever number of people were at the time became like family. We took it very seriously, and we all had very real love for each other, I think. You know, young musicians can be arrogant and sort of seeking to fulfill their own agenda.
Yeah.
And somehow you were able to get us all sort of pointed in the same direction, which kind of seems like a miracle in hindsight. And to watch someone like you, you know, take the creation of art so seriously, it made us kind of really truly realize what the stakes were for artistic creation, the way it, you know, really helps us live our lives. And it changed me permanently. I mean, there's not a single person who was involved with Sweet Mother Child that I don't look back on with, you know, serious love and affection. Like I said, I don't think the majority of people get to experience that kind of thing. You know, a lot of us were in college while that was all kind of going down, but the stuff we were doing in school was sort of secondary. It was like this notion that really great things can happen when there's like kind of serious commitment and shared sense of purpose and focus. And one of the cool things about it in hindsight too was just the fact that everybody liked each other.
Yeah.
That many people working together on a project, and it was just so I have really, really fond memories of it, like every single person. And then so to be involved in that kind of collective also means that, generally speaking, everyone's looking for their moment to do their thing, and here you have a rare case of a real shared sense of purpose. So it was really fun, and also just frankly, like, as you know better than anybody, playing live music is the best thing in the world, especially when you're doing it with an ensemble like that.
Yeah. Well, that's a fantastic way to put it, John. Your way with words never ceases to amaze me. Can you stick around with us for another minute? We're going to play a song, and then we can come back and do some more questions.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay, great. We're going to play Horizontal Insomnia. You were speaking about the art and the large scope of the art. I thought I'd play this one. Horizontal Insomnia from the band's what is it, fifth album, Histories, released in 2001, and it features Chris Monty on the drums, Sean Carmichael on the bass, John Deming, who we have with us today, on the guitar, as well as Josh Barabo on the guitar, myself on the keys. We have on this song on the horns, I believe it was Mike Ritchie on trumpet, Matt Soucy on saxophone, and did Adam Troll play on this one? He did, didn't he?
Yeah, I believe so.
Adam Troll and Mike Ritchie on trumpet, right? And Matt Soucy on saxophone, and Lise Bedrosian and Andrea Quigley on backup vocals. And this was kind of like a fusion-y, crazy piece of art. When you were speaking about sort of the connection between the band, this song came to mind. So we're going to play it real quick. We're going to come right back with John Deming with a few more questions about Sweet Mother Child, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the formation of Sweet Mother Child. Once again, this is Horizontal Insomnia. You are listening to Danny on Everything. We'll be right back. We are back. Danny on everything. My name is Danny Bedrosian. We're talking to John Deming, guitarist, professor, poet, writer, genius, traveler, New Yorker, and New Englander. That's a deep one. John, we had just played Horizontal Insomnia, and just thinking about those melodies and those rhythms and the things that we did. And I remember with that song specifically, that was one you, myself, and our drummer, Chris Monty, I think we cut our parts together on that song, if you remember.
Right.
Because I feel like our parts were sort of all very much in sync. And then I think we overdubbed Josh's guitar and Sean's bass and then the horns and the vocals and all, and then all the other auxiliary stuff. It was quite a, that was quite an undertaking, that song.
Oh my God, I remember sitting in the hallway of your dorm room with, you know, Matt and you, and you were like, okay guys, I got something new, and we're like, okay, great, a new Danny song, and then you kind of, we realized the scope of the thing pretty quickly. Yeah, it was kind of terrifying.
Yeah, and I think I remember we used that as our, when we were going through bass players at one point in like 2001 or 2, I think we used that as our audition song.
Oh God, yeah, I know.
That was what we were trying out bassists with. That was so funny to
Danny
me.
Danny was listening to Chick Corea. What were you? You were into all kind of stuff.
Like, yeah.
I don't know. It was like, whatever was inspiring you at the time, you were looking to really, really push it. You know?
Yeah.
And you, one of the things that I loved about that was this kind of confidence that with enough pushing, everyone else could play these parts too. Like, you had that, to feel like you had the faith of your band leader was always a good thing, you know?
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. John, speaking of songs, and I know this is a cliche question or maybe more importantly, just kind of a tough question, but what was your favorite or one of your favorite or a couple of your favorite songs in Sweet Mother Child and why?
Well, let me start with, I can give you a couple, but the one that's on the tip of my tongue is probably Artificial Intelligence, AI we call it. The reason being, it was probably my favorite contribution that I had anything to do with it, but this was co-written. I wrote it with you and with Sean Carmichael.
That's right.
And it was just one that really, really worked. It had the heavy kind of like funk, like metal riff rock thing going, mixed with something kind of sophisticated too. And I remember, I mentioned Josh Farrable before. I was somebody who had not the easiest time winning the approval of Josh. And I remember one time referring to the ending of that song that you and I constructed as being just like epic or something like that, and I was like, oh damn, like kind words from Josh, we must have done something right, you know.
Yeah, that's
and, always, and that was the one also that we could play live anytime with you would give us no real lead in time. It would be like, hey, I want to like just it would just start throw down, you know. A lot of great memories about that, but I love, you know, for live performance, Mitchell Funny's great because we bring rappers in. Bump Tonight is one of my sort of like enduring favorites. You know, from the early days, for some reason I always had a really strong affection for Mr. Sandman, which is sort of like the banjo sounding. I think you said that you and Mark came up with the idea by watching like guys in a gazebo at Canopy Lake Park playing like whatever kind of folksy music.
Wow!
But yeah, you know, I could go on and on. There were a lot of great.
That's incredible insight for me, John, because you're telling me things that I forgot. You know. Like, I totally forget, and that's 100% what it was. We were at Canopy Lake Park back in the day when we were little kids, and Mark and I used to see these, like, I guess they were country. I mean, to consider a band a country band in New England, they're probably calling it country and western, which really shows, like, like the faux pas-ness of, or the ingenuineness of the country music that we were probably hearing.
Well, I think it's like guys wearing vests. Fucking on banjos and that sort of thing,
right?
And somehow it didn't sound remotely out of place on this like funk album,
right?
So that's been a big thing with P-Funk as well. Anyway, the idea that you can kind of like bring all these genres in to make this one kind of massive form of music that could all be sort of filed under funk, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's a certain, I think George Clinton largely and Bernie Worrell and just Parliament Funkadelic in general had a large part to do with that sort of diversity and irreverence and ability to sort of shape things with different genres and still for it to be a funk album. I actually was talking about the Soul Servant album with a couple friends the other day because we were comparing it to another album that had just come out or talking about another album that had just come out that was a really sort of irreverent album where there was like a bunch of different genres. And I brought up Soul Servant because I was like, well, Soul Servant was the first album I produced. Because our first album, Unhealthy Groove Music, which came out in 98, I didn't produce it. Our original bass player, Alex Rodriguez, who was an engineer for Maurice Starr, who did the New Edition and New Kids on the Block albums as an engineer, was much more well-trained in the world of production and engineering than I. And so we let him produce the first one. But the second album, Soul Servant, in which every song is probably a totally different subgenre, was my first production. And I remember thinking, or telling a buddy of mine, well, you know, you got to sort of get that out of your system in a way, the idea of the diversified album, quote unquote. Because I remember, you know, one song was like dance funk and one was like psychedelic and one was country and one sounded like Radiohead and one was like reggae and one was more like P-Funk and one was more like Chili Peppers and one, you know what I mean? They just like, and there was a classical one and it was just all over the place. But somehow it actually worked as a real album, and it had...
Well, you know, for me, as someone on the outside, like, I liked Unhealthy Groove Music, but I loved Soul Servant, and that's kind of when it got real to me. Like, that was the, you know, and that idea, like, you mentioned Radiohead, so I remember seeing some interview with a couple of the guys from Radiohead when they did Austin City Limits, and they were talking about how they work often that way, too, though, where, they, like, one given album, like in Rainbows or something, could have six different styles, but because the band is kind of so comfortable working together and what they're doing, that it comes off. Like, the way that they would put it was making an album was a way of kind of contextualizing all this different flailing around that they were doing. And it's a hard thing to pull off, but when you do it, it's right. And Soul Servant was totally that to me, you know?
Yeah, I agree. You know, we were listening to a lot of really different things. We were listening to P-Funk, and we were listening to Sun Ra, and Radiohead, and the Beatles, and James Brown, and Sly and the Family Stone, and all these sort of disparate things, and trying to find what Return to Forever, and Chick Corea, and Maharaja and Miles Davis circa Bitches Brew, you know, and like we were like really trying to do certain things a very specific way, even to the point where I remember there was one period where we were doing a lot of covers. We were doing weddings and things, and we had like incorporated like 100 covers into our set. You remember that?
Yeah, oh, totally, yeah.
So interesting.
But of course, there's Yank Yank gonna do that to me, which was just straight up hand song, you know?
Yeah. It brings me to my next question too, John. Is there a favorite moment or maybe a favorite concert or show or anything like that that you remember that just sticks out in your mind as the, you know, one of the pivotal moments for you in the band?
I honestly feel like one of the obvious ones that comes to mind is that time that there were like a few thousand people there when we were playing outdoors during the Q&A kind of festival. But really the big thing for me is the little, like, they sort of are all awash in my head, but all the little shows at places like frat houses or that house out in Lee or wherever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was, and they were kind of shitty. Like, it would be like kind of a lot of people kind of dancing. It was dirty. You know, my friend Nate is running beer to the band. I remember one time spilled a whole pitcher into my amplifier, and I had to run direct through the PA for the rest of the show.
Which I loved.
That kind of stuff, but really all of them kind of. And then on that front, really the other thing that's the most memorable to me is also that you were sort of like not making us, we wanted to go, but I guess kind of making us go to all the P-Funk shows almost as like required reading.
Yeah.
And you know, we would be there, and you would also be handing off CDs to all these guys in P-Funk. And then there was one night where we were just kind of there late enough, and we all went out to eat with a couple of the guys. I would think it was Jerome and a couple people.
Mm-hmm.
Jerome Rogers, and then. And that was the first time that you were sort of invited to go try to play with them, and they were, I think, just like, holy shit, this guy can play. You know what I mean?
Nice.
Like beyond being like this sort of P-Funk fan, all of a sudden there was like this real formidable talent in front of them. And so that's really memorable to me, too, this idea that we were the kind of the Venn diagram of Sweet Mother Child. And
yeah, for sure. And it's that first one you mentioned. I'm sorry, that first show you mentioned, too, the one outside the frat.
Yeah.
I have to corroborate that. Like there was a 9.5 hour show. We played from 4:30 to 2. Do you remember that?
Totally.
4:30 in the afternoon to 2 in the morning, and we only repeated 2 songs. That's how much music we had. And I think
and also we didn't have to, it wasn't like anybody would be confused and say, what was that one again? again.
Like, I know, but we did only repeat two, and I think it was like it was Cycles, which was a Sloptopus song, and it was No Diggity. And the only break that I took was to let our drummer at the time, Seth Cedars, take a break, and I played drums for two songs.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. It was like all hands on deck, you know.
So funny. This is amazing. Now, John, how did this band, or what was the, how should I put this? Like, what was it about this band that sort of influenced you further in the world of the arts? You touched on it a little bit. Give us like a little rundown of like what it meant to you after it was all over and where you went from there.
Well, one of the only artists that I've ever encountered in my life that had a vision as large as George Clinton is the poet Walt Whitman.
Mm.
It's like they're similar in the sense that there's this gigantic and cosmic kind of thing that's going on that's also kind of cartoonish and ridiculous, but at the same time actually very sincere. And the idea that you can kind of have it both ways. I remember I was teaching women to a class some years ago, and this kid was, I was talking about the idea of incorporating like almost like the totality of reality on some level, you know, in your mind in a way that even if you couldn't fully kind of sort of get it, you're sort of attempting to. It would almost be like to have, like, or to entertain two competing ideas at the same time and be okay with that and not necessarily have to have the answers. Like all this kind of openness that goes on. And this one kid in class kind of being like, well, you would have to be insane to have a mind that could do that. And I was thinking, well, that's, you know, that's sort of true. But I think that Parliament Funkadelic and Putting on the Child and that sort of thing really affected my worldview. And also, like, the seriousness of purpose with which you, you know, you have to, like, rehearse. Like you mentioned before, we could have 100 songs and no one would have to think twice about playing them because of repetition.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that by doing something again and again and again, you can just kind of trust the process and realize that even if you don't end up where you thought you were going to be, you're going to end up somewhere. It's certainly something that I applied to everything I've done since then, whether it was trying to publish poetry or get involved in, you know, teaching and all that sort of thing. But also just like there's a certain kind of, for all the stress of trying to play music and get it right and whatever, there's a kind of zen thing that happens when you have a mentality like that of George Clinton, which is what sort of what you were adopting for Sweet Mother Child. And that filtered through you to that group because everybody was kind of building love for each other. And I think that, like, it in general, it fosters a sense of empathy that I think is really important, and that is that art can really kind of do. This idea of just kind of like seeing and accepting other perspectives and all that stuff. And really, like, having that group and doing all that stuff and learning all about George and, like, all that kind of thing. I mean, it steered me down an entire direction. You know, I spent my entire professional life now doing poetry and music and, like, and that sort of thing, and like sort of teaching and trying to have conversations about like sort of really sort of difficult and sort of mind-bending ideas and all that stuff. It was kind of everything, you know. And also like the idea of striving to find community, like what it means to work with other people in groups on things, letting everyone have their say while also having to, you know, work for the good of the community, so to speak.
Yeah.
All of that, you know.
That's fantastic, John. And that leads me to my next question I wanted to ask you. You have a new poetry book out. We spoke a little bit about it in the intro. It's called Headline News. And I read it last time I was in Manhattan visiting with you guys, the Cold Front family. And I read the, I guess it was like, you know, it might have been before it was out. Was it before it was out?
It's actually technically not out yet.
Okay, gotcha.
You can actually order it now, like, as, like, it's National Poetry Month, so the publisher is doing, like, free shipping for the month of April.
Oh, nice.
That was definitely well before it was out, for sure.
So, okay, that's fantastic. So, like, upon reading it, I just have to say, I was viscerally struck immediately, like I always am, by your work. You're a fantastic poet. Your way with words is incredible. The way you express words on the written page is it confounds me to this day. And it's some of the most beautiful poetry I've ever read, John. Really, and I mean beautiful in every sense of the word. Beautiful in its beauty, sometimes beautiful in its ugliness, sometimes beautiful in its grittiness, sometimes beautiful in its professionalism, in its stance and it's coarse, but there's always something about it that I'm just like, God, that's a good piece of art right there. And I mean, several of those pieces, and some of them take on a real minimalist character, really struck me in a way where I was feeling emotions that I had felt from memories of my past. Like, you really struck a transcendent tone in my heart when I read the work. And I'm not just saying that because we're friends. It really, really spoke to me. So why don't you tell the listeners for a minute just what influenced Headline News and what was your impetus for creating it?
Well, it's funny also, you mentioned before too the lasting influence of the defunct stuff. There's a the cartoon that's on the cover of the book was something that I really liked because it was drawn by my uncle, who's a cartoonist, but it reminded me of a lot of the old Pedro Bell cartoons that were on the covers of Funkadelic albums.
Yeah.
Like that. But yeah, no, really what it's kind of doing is it's, I guess I'm sort of interested in, it's a sequence of 72 10-line poems, and I've always, you know, I'm sort of interested in the ways that addiction and media consumption relate to things like anxiety and depression and that sort of thing, which is kind of only getting bigger and bigger now. I worked in journalism for a bit as a reporter, and I've always loved the way that the headlines kind of talk to you in weird ways, and it's also true that people read headlines more than they read actual news, so like the editors get read more than the reporters was like a truism when I was learning journalism. But anyway, it's a way of kind of like, these things are always kind of going by. If you think of like the ticker scroll, I used to have that as a job too, writing like ticker headlines, and the way that those things just kind of bounce off your own existence while you're still worrying about whatever the anxieties are in your life, your like relationships and bills and so forth and money and whatever, that we're also sort of like constantly immersed in this kind of thing. And so to what extent is what's going on in kind of your own scattered brain also being like filtered and influenced with all this other stuff going on too? So in any case, like, each one is 10 lines, and the goal was to kind of write something that could be read like in about the amount of time that it takes to listen to an album of music, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so you could do, depending on how many times you've read it, you could probably redo it in half an hour, 40 minutes, something like that. But the hope is that the more you do it, the different things kind of open up. And each one has like a headline that's real that I took someplace from, you know, news media. And they're used sometimes for context, sometimes for rhythm or for rhyme. Sometimes it's not related at all. Other times it would be like I had something going and I needed to rhyme. Other times it's just very much the content. And it was sort of like, when you have a project going like that that's generative, it's kind of always there for you. And, you know, I wound up having 72, but I probably wrote 200 of these things.
Wow.
Sort of trying to figure out a way to organize them at some point. And, you know, ultimately, like, I what happened was, you know, when Trump was elected, I had been working on this thing for like a few years, and I was just kind of finishing it as that was going down. And it sort of seemed to me to be almost kind of, in some ways, telling the story of my own scattered mind in the years leading up to that. But then also, hopefully, anything that's too personal is kind of boring, in a certain way. So the hope is that it just sort of becomes this sort of interesting kind of artistic experiment that you kind of like, that can kind of open up the more that you dig into it, you know?
I sense upon reading it, when I first read it, a dichotomy of thoughts, or maybe, forgive my verbiage, a trichotomy, if you will. The headlines, which were so filled with tension and, like you said, media like seeping into your world, and your thoughts, the things that were coming from you, the real legitimate John Deming thoughts, and the third thing, making it sort of trichotomy, are my thoughts, the transcendence that you carried on into the reader's mind. And what I've always said about good music, good poetry, good writing, good movies, whatever, is that transcendence is such a key part about it. You know what I mean? You know, if you got some dude to end up in your garden and he's in there thinking that you wrote all those poems or songs or whatever about him, you managed to transcend something.
Yeah, well, that's where a lot of my interest in this stuff came from, Danny. Like, this idea that you kind of, you know, like in the abstract world, like if I say the word donkey to you, which I say now just because I'm sitting in a bar in the village and for some reason they have Shrek on the television and I'm looking at a donkey. you know, like I say that word to you, it triggers a very specific association and you picture an image in your head. As opposed to if I play a C minor chord on a piano, it triggers associations, but they're more abstract, they're not literal. And so to me, like, poetry is an interesting, if you think that, like, language is sound that has very, like, you know, sort of literal representation, and whereas, like, music
It's amazing. John, tell everybody one more time where they'll be able to get headline news when it's available.
They can order it right now if they go to indolentbooks.com.
Okay. And also, I highly recommend people to check out Cold Front. And
yes.
The website for that is what's coldfront.com?
No, it is coldfrontmag.com.
Okay, coldfrontmag.com. And it's just an amazing poetry magazine. John Deming and Melinda Wilson co-run it and just have an amazing staff of people working with them. They are checking out poetry and literature and sometimes music from all over the world, aren't you, John?
Oh, yeah, totally. We've had a range of different... You know, we had Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth write one of our Song of the Weeks one time. It's just been... there's a lot of range.
Really? And I'm always interested in what it is you guys are talking about next. It's really just a fantastic foray into the poetry world and other worlds within the arts. And I applaud you for real, my brother. I applaud you for everything you're doing. I highly recommend everybody check out Headline News. John, we're gonna play one more. Here's another one that actually you're on as well. It's called Bump in the Night. It was one you mentioned was one of your favorites. It was on the last Sweet Mother Child album, Monofunxitism, released in 2003. Features on the drums, Seth Cedars. On the bass, Jeff Bonhag. On guitars, Josh Barabow, our friend Mr. John Deming, who we have here. As well as, is Mark Munoz on that one too?
Yeah.
And Mark Munoz. We have... on the saxophone, Matt Soucy. On the trumpet, Nick Winslow and Adam Trull. And on the vocals, myself, Ken Wilk on the intro, and Steve Robidoux and Elise Bedrosian and Andrea Quigley. And we're going to hear that now. John, thank you so much for being with us today and talking about Sweet Mother Child.
Oh, yeah, it's my pleasure, Danny. Thank you so much for calling. It's really great to think about, and I look forward to listening back, you know?
Yes, and we're going to have you come back on, too, and talk more about Cold Front and on what you're doing.
Anytime. Yeah, anytime. Thank you.
Thank you. It was John Deming.
Congratulations, too. This show is awesome.
Thank you so much, John. John Deming, and we're about to hear Bump in the Night by Sweet Mother Child, celebrating the 20th anniversary of Sweet Mother Child. This is Danny on Everything.
Baby, make a 90-degree right turn over here. Say shit's gonna be so tight, it will burn, my dear. I'm your grandma's personal chapstick. Leave the blowing to the breeze. Freak nasty, freak nasty. Light. kisses, and I fantasize about the places in our lives where we should be. They got big budget mansions and races with buildings soon we don't tie our laces. That's the way that they all see. A plastic Hollywood coat and cases with a fluff bed without much faces, blocking out the free. We're just invisible cartoon faces. In and out we left no traces. In your hedgehog in the tree.
Freak nasty, freak nasty.
With Danny on everything. We just heard the song Bump Into Night by Sweet Mother Child, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the band's formation. And now I am very proud to introduce a brand new segment on the show, Sith and Synth, with my dear friend Travis Thigpen. Travis is our resident Star Wars expert. He's going to talk to us about the things he loves and the things he hates about Star Wars right now, while I dilly-dally on the Novation Base Station 2. Travis is currently studying at Tallahassee Community College and is a dear, dear friend of mine, raised in Bradenton, Florida, born in Miami, a true Floridian, living here in Tallahassee now. Travis, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Danny.
So, there have been some obvious changes since Disney has taken over the Star Wars franchise, as it were. Most notably, the direction that they have taken with the films, I would say. To you, what's your take on the newest film, The Last Jedi?
Well, first off, I'd like to say that one of the big mistakes that Disney made when they purchased Lucasfilm was they wanted new and upcoming directors to direct these films, which is fine. But what they decided to do was have a different director for each film in this new trilogy. Starting off with J.J. Abrams.
Right.
Going
Who
to,
I liked.
Yeah, he started off nice. It's kind of a rehash of A New Hope and had a little bit of Empire in it.
Yeah,
but
it's New Hope-ish.
But it was able to kickstart this franchise again and get everybody excited and speculating on the future of the Star Wars franchise.
Right.
Second in that, you had Rian Johnson, whose most notable work is Looper. And to finish out the trilogy, originally it was going to be Colin Trevorrow, the guy that did Jurassic World.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He ended up being fired, and it's recently came out, because J.J. is now taking over Episode Nine. It's recently came out that he was fired because he wanted Luke to be able to survive through Episode 8 and into 9. Luke was a big part of his plans, and for whatever reason, Lucasfilm has done everything in their ability to crush your image of Luke and what you wanted from him after 30 years of a hiatus from him. So in regards to The Last Jedi, I don't want to, you know, just completely bitch about it. There are a few positives that I took away from the movie. First off, Carrie Fisher, rest in peace, and Mark Hamill's acting were some of the finest of their careers.
I agree.
I was blown away by what they put on screen. Not to mention, the movie was beautifully shot. I mean, no one could take that away from it. The scene in the where Holdo flies her ship through Snoke's flagship. I mean, I was silent as the rest of the movie theater.
It was an incredible scene.
It's incredible. It took my breath away. But that is where the positives for this movie actually ended for me.
Okay.
And this movie, for me, is riddled with plot holes and agenda-driven narratives that do not fit within the overall Star Wars universe.
Hmm.
And these narratives come from Kathleen Kennedy, from the very top of Lucasfilm.
Right. At Disney, she works for Disney, right? She's a Disney exec?
She's the CEO of Lucasfilm, or the president of it.
But
Bob Iger is the guy that is the CEO of Disney Film. So, from the very beginning of the movie, you're bombarded with Marvel-esque humor that once again has no place in Star Wars. The movie actually opens up with cell phone humor, like, can you hear me now, and I'll hold, when Poe is attacking the Dreadnought ship, and he's talking to General Hux. To me, that brought the opening scene and the whole movie to a complete standstill. You know, from that scene on, you go into the bombardment of the Dreadnought that Poe was trying to make more time for, you know, by his little Marvel
mutiny
jokes. His mutiny came later, which is just absolutely ridiculous. But I don't know if anybody knows this, but in science, like, and in space and science, the way this works.
Tell us about the science.
Gravity in space is non-existent for the most part, unless you come up near a star or a planet or something that has enough gravity to draw you in. The bombs that they were dropping onto the Dreadnought to actually destroy it would have never happened, only unless they were magnetized, which was never stated in the novelization or the movie itself.
Right.
You know, in that scene, that's one of the plot holes that just really opened up the movie to me, to where are we going with this? From there, you get General Hux, who set up in The Force Awakens to be a very capable general who led the First Order with an iron fist. But now in The Last Jedi, we find Hux as a sniffling little man whose only real point in being in the movie is to be the butt of the joke.
Right.
I mean, when he got slammed on his face by Snoke in front of all his underlings,
right.
I mean, he loses all credence at that point. You're the general of, you know, the First Order. Who's going to follow you in the battle when Snoke is this body slamming you into the ground? And the faces this man made in these shots just totally got me.
Who, Hux?
Yes. Right. Yeah, where he's just like, oh my god, I'm going to have to talk to Snoke.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. Yeah.
Now, I don't know about everybody else, but I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and I've been waiting for over 30 years to once again see Luke Skywalker in action and learn about what knowledge he has obtained in the Force over those 30 years.
Right.
But instead, we find a broken-down, bitter old man who chucks the Skywalker lightsaber once again for a laugh. I mean, as soon as he's handed to it, he kind of just gazes at it. Yeah, I remember that when it got cut from my body and fell down a shaft.
Right.
And then flippantly throws it over his shoulder and walks away. To me, think about it. The last time Luke saw the lightsaber, it was falling down a shaft, clenched by his own hand that his father had just severed from his body. Now, do you think for one second Luke Skywalker, who fought with everything he had to save his father from evil and saw only the tiniest bit of hope in him, would have just so flippantly threw this last memento of his father over the cliff?
Yeah, I think, well, I think that part was supposed to sort of show his flippant behavior towards the Jedi Order post the destruction of his little order, whatever you call his little thing. Which is maybe the biggest problem I had with the movie was the scene where, the spoiler alert, anybody who hasn't seen it, the scene where Luke realizes or whatever that what's his face there is evil. That there's a flicker of evil in his nephew.
Yes.
And he decides in the funniest, I mean to me it was funny, the funniest way possible, he's like, oh, like he's gonna kill him, and at the last second, kid wakes up and knocks the building down on him or whatever it was.
Once again, it was a complete waste of scenes. We had three different tellings of that story.
Right.
But we couldn't get a Han funeral. You know, I mean, that was supposed to be one of the big things in this movie, was to open up with the Han funeral. Right. I mean, he is one of the greatest characters in the Star Wars universe, and just to forget about him.
Right.
You know, they actually cut a scene, it's in the now released deleted scenes, where Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia are actually force connected, and they're grieving Han Solo.
Oh, I never saw that.
Yeah, because it's in the deleted scenes, because Rian Johnson thought that titty milk was a better scene to put in there.
Okay. And you're referencing the strange aliens that
milking
Luke,
scene.
Luke was milking.
Yes,
on the
yes. With that look of like, good, right at the end of it. I mean, is that the Luke Skywalker? Is that the farm boy that we all knew and loved, the great hope of the universe or that galaxy?
No, I mean, there were some anticlimactic things about this movie, I will certainly say. We talked about this a little bit before, and I was saying how, you know, upon my first watch, I really liked it, but I have only seen it once, and I think my expectations were slightly lower than yours, because I think I saw less before.
I speculated for 2 years and watched all these YouTubers. And then they say that I'm upset because my theory didn't come true. It's like,
what was
no,
your theory?
I didn't have a specific one. I loved them all, whether she was a Kenobi, whether she was Palpatine's daughter.
Which we still don't know. We still don't know anything
about. No,
they
can all be retcon, but that's the problem with taking three directors from the very beginning.
Right.
You should have had an overall vision, or at least laid out the where you wanted to go in this series, right, so that the other directors are like, well, no matter what, I can put my opinion in here, but we need to get to this point. And that's what these three movies clearly lack. I brought this up to you in our earlier conversation. Does this movie not feel like an end to you?
Yes.
Then a middle?
Yes, there's lots of different sort of like things that point to, again, spoiler alert, things that point to it being an ending. Snoke's death. The sort of the thing with the First Order kind of being split, it being sort of fought over piecemeal, the death of Luke, obviously, the near death of Leia, which, really, to be honest with you, even though I liked the film, I thought that she should...
Leia and Poppins, ladies and gentlemen.
I thought she should have died when Admiral Ackbar died. I thought that should have been when she should have just died. I mean, it would have gone, again, I mean, I guess... It's not necessary to make her die when she really dies, but I just figured that's when she would.
And I get it, because Disney has come out and said that she passed after filming was completed, and they wanted to honor her final performance.
Oh, okay.
Which I completely understand and respect that.
Yeah, for sure.
There had to be a way to write around it. You know, if you know that Leia's not coming back and you're going to have to write her out somehow, whether in a novel or whatever, a time jump or something like that, maybe make it where Luke doesn't die at the end.
Right.
Especially in such a sorry way. I mean, he just kind of smiles and just floats off into space.
Yeah, it was kind of weird.
It was, especially because after that, Rian Johnson came out and said that we took that from the expanded universe, which, if anybody watches Rebels, you've already seen this doppelganger thing happen when Yoda
does it.
Yeah, he contacts Ezra, and he's sitting there on a log in front of him. It didn't kill Yoda. He still lasted for another 10, 15 years after that to train Luke or whatever. But it actually comes from the expanded universe, And in there, there's a Sith Lord who can double or triple the size of his army with doppelgangers, like ships. I mean, he could doppelganger everything.
Who was that?
I can't remember the Sith Lord's name. He's kind of a little known one. He's just an expanded. He's not like Bane or anything like that. But he was able to do that. And then there was another lesser known Jedi female that was able to send just herself.
Huh.
To these places, and they acted autonomously.
Huh.
Yeah, she didn't even have to control them. They would just, they had a piece of her memory or her psyche and would know what they needed to do and would do it. And once their mission was fulfilled, they would come back to her.
Huh.
So, I mean, we all kind of knew that, you know, what this doppelganger thing was. The thing was, is that the expanded universe had no instance of anybody dying.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the most powerful Jedi of all time, maybe the chosen one, Luke Skywalker.
Right.
And that's something that just really got me. And now we have interviews coming out from Mark Hamill himself, like on comicbook.com and stuff like that, actually stating that he has no interest in coming back to Star Wars at this point.
Even as a Force ghost?
Even as a Force ghost. He's like, Luke's story is over. What more needs to be told? And then you get another report today. An article in the New York Daily News confirms Yoda's Force ghost will return for Episode 9 and will acknowledge Rey's success as a Jedi while also mentoring her.
Huh. Well, you know what I did like about the movie a lot, too, was the return. I mean, it's kind of weird, but the return of the puppet Yoda.
Yeah, Frank Oz, that was Yoda. That was beautiful.
That
beautiful.
Was amazing. I mean,
no one wants to see that CGI Yoda again.
Yeah, no. And I also just think that, like, it looked like Yoda that died on his deathbed when Luke, it was like the same puppet. You could tell it was him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I was like, I really dug that.
I did too, but the problem with bringing Yoda back in 9, wasn't that supposed to be the purpose of Luke in 8 was to mentor Rey and to train her in the ways of the Force?
Right.
But now we're going to have to get that in Episode 9 because Rian Johnson's plan was, hey, you old timers, you core Star Wars fans, I'm going to kill everything you love.
Wow.
You know, who's one of your favorite characters that I know of?
Admiral Ackbar.
Admiral Ackbar. How did you feel about the death of Admiral Ackbar?
Didn't even really see him die.
I mean,
it was so fast. I'm sure if I slowed it down or something, I'd probably see him fly out of the...
Maybe Kylo flew through him, you know, something like that. But, I mean, in the novels, Ackbar is retired.
Leia brings him back.
I need you to help me with this. It's you and me, Ackbar. And then you just so casually kill this man. The hero, you know, one of the main heroes of the Resistance.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy. So, needless to say, you're not a huge fan of The Last Jedi.
I left out about 10 million things that I could have picked apart there. I mean, honestly. let's just say this. The whole Canto Bight scene, let alone, would have been saved if Finn and, what's her name, Rose Tico, would have just found a parking spot instead of parking on the beach. I mean, the whole 45 minutes of the movie would have been just completely, they would have went and found the hacker that they needed. Nothing would have happened. You know, they just had to find a parking spot. But no, they land on the beach.
So, okay, So it's easy to see that to you, Disney kind of made a mess out of this movie. But
the franchise.
The whole franchise.
Yeah.
But there's a ray of hope.
A ray.
A ray of new hope. and that is with the show Rebels, right? That Disney has on the Disney Channel.
My favorite thing that Disney has done since they purchased Lucasfilm.
Well, let's talk about Rebels a little bit. And tell me what it is about the show that made you really feel that they did it right. Because I actually agree with you, but I want to hear your take.
Well, Dave, I always butcher his last name. I think it's Filoni or Fioni or something.
Yeah.
He is George Lucas's protege.
Right.
He actually worked with him on the Clone Wars animated series and helped him on the movies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what his official title was or anything like that. For anybody that knows who Ahsoka Tano is, he is the creator of Ahsoka Tano.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, who was not the most loved character.
When
the
Clone Wars came out.
Yeah. I mean, when that first animated movie came out, people despised her, and she has grown through trials and tribulation, unlike Rey, into one of Star Wars' most beloved characters.
And a stronger... We see her grow very strong in the end of Rebels.
Yes, through progression.
But, you know, my favorite thing about Rebels was Kanan and Hera. The love affair between Kanan and Hera. I think it would be safe to say, and we've spoken about this at length before, maybe the best love affair or whatever, the best romance in Star Wars history?
Since the only one you really have to compare it to that's not in, you know, expanded universe is Leia and Han, and there's a bunch
Leia
of quips.
Leia and Jabba was a thing. Some people say Lando and the guy with the weird head guy there, Cloud City. That was
Oh, yeah.
That's a whole thing.
He's kind of explained in some of the novels, though, yeah. He's basically Chewbacca to Han to Lando.
Right, exactly.
Got a life debt.
But getting back to Rebels, though, the Hera and Kanan, and again, spoiler alert, the death of Kanan is something that really touched a lot of people. I think I told you that the same night that I saw that, I saw the series finale of Vikings, which is a show I watch all the time, and like 7 or 8 major characters were killed. I shed not one tear. I was like, oh, he died. Oh, she's gone. Oh. And then Kanan died on a cartoon. A character on a cartoon
and
died.
And you bawled.
And I bawled. I was like, no, Kanan.
There's many scenes in that series that, you know, for a cartoon and me being a grown man,
sure,
has brought me to tears.
Yeah, it's really
even the episodes that we were watching last night to get ready for the show and the right. series finale. I mean, there's a
amazing
couple moments that will bring you to, when you see Hera touch her belly. I don't know if you picked that up.
I didn't until after.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's their kid. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Jason Syndulla.
Jason Syndulla.
Yep.
Amazing.
I'm wondering if, because, you know, Dave Filoni is actually going to do another series. He's not going to get a directing job, which we all want. You know, what I actually want out of Disney is I don't need Kathleen Kennedy to be fired. What I need her to do is not be on the creative side.
Right, I feel you.
Of Disney. And Dave Filoni is the man. He was handpicked by George Lucas to run his animation department with full trust. I believe this is the man. And after,
and isn't he in Rebels? Isn't he a character on the Rebels show? Wasn't he like...
He voiced the guy with the glasses that had the...
It was made to look like him, though, too, wasn't it?
Kinda.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the guy, like the Cloud City guy. He had that thing around his head. There were the ISB officers or whatever, mm-hmm. the intelligence guys. Yes, he voiced... I think actually a couple characters on that show.
Now, does he have anything to do with the Han Solo movie? Do we know? Who's doing the Han Solo movie?
Lauren and Miller, the guys that did 21 Jump Street and the Batman Lego movie. These are their two movies, their claims to fame. So they were originally hired to be the directors of the movie, and then they were fired with reports coming out that Kathleen Kennedy hated them so much that she didn't even like the way that they folded their socks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So basically, the reports were that because the Han Solo movie is actually Lawrence Kasdan's final script. He is the guy that wrote most of Star Wars with George Lucas. I mean, he is the man at Star Wars. And this is his final script, and he has stated numerous times it is his best script.
Really?
Yeah. And Lorne and Miller, I guess, butchered it so much that people that had seen, you know, excerpts of it or whatever, people in the know, basically, mm-hmm. said that it was beginning to look a lot like Ace Ventura: Pet Detective.
No.
Yes. Which, I mean, if anybody saw 21 Jump Street, I mean, you can see
Han Solo, Pet Detective.
Exactly. Exactly. So they fired them and brought in one of the greats, Ron Howard.
Oh, fantastic director. Yeah.
And he is reshot from reports about 80% of the movie.
And he's got a great aesthetic that I could see work for the Star Wars world.
Yes.
Like, I feel like he would pay attention to the aesthetic. Because so many people care so much about the aesthetic of the movie. And even though it's a Star Wars story, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
one of the sort of semi-unrelated.
Along with Rogue One. And,
sort of canonical but non-trilogized, whatever.
It has nothing to do with the Skywalker.
Right, exactly. But that being said, I think, I mean, and I liked Rogue One a lot. We've spoken about this before. So you're not the biggest fan of Rogue One.
Some of the worst writing.
But I like the movie. I like the movie, and the things I like about it are, the pre-New Hope Imperial Command and the Rebel meetings. Like, the, all the stuff that related to the military.
You love the politics of
I love the politics. Stuff. And you know I love the military stuff, too. Yeah. I love the actual Star Wars. Yeah. Like, that's my stuff.
And just to piggyback off of Rogue One, mm-hmm. I tried to get ready for this interview mm-hmm. to re-watch The Last Jedi on DVD.
How far did you get?
48 minutes into it. And I turned it off with my head in my hands, like, what is this piece of trash? What is this abomination of a movie that they're forcing me to watch? Now, you know how much I don't like Rogue One.
Right.
I can watch it.
Right.
You know, and I mean, yes, the last 5 minutes with Vader just destroying everything is the reason I can watch it. And if he wasn't in that movie,
that is an awesome.
It would be just as bad as The Last Jedi. I mean, just go back to anybody that's a big fan of Rogue One and listen to Jyn Erso's speech to all the men sitting around her to get them hyped up to go and die. I mean, it's like a four-year-old wrote that. She's like, yeah, we could, you know, kind of, maybe, I don't know, we have hope. It's like, okay, cool.
Yeah, so. So, moving ahead to beyond Han Solo and beyond that movie, there's going to be an episode 9, as we all know.
Yep. Next, close out the sequel trilogy.
Close out the sequel trilogy, and it's going to come out next
2019. It was originally slated for December, but I do not know if they're gonna bring it back to May. But so far, still in December of 2019. So this will be the longest gap we have between movies since Disney's owned it.
Wow, very, very interesting. And what are your speculations about Episode 9? Well, it's an Abrams film, right?
J.J. Abrams
brought him back for fear of another reprisal.
Yeah,
they knew he was safe. And so,
is he safe though?
I think it's better to pick the safe Abrams than the hated Johnson at this point.
Oh yeah, no one wants Johnson, and that's a lot of the reason why I'm actually not going to support Episode 9.
Really?
Yes, I refuse until there is a changing of the guard. Like I said,
so you don't think the movie will do anything for you?
It's not for me personally.
No.
Like we discussed earlier in the interview,
yep.
8 is an end. Where do you go from here? What do I care about?
But you're
going
to see it.
I will give $1 to Redbox to rent this movie after it comes out. I refuse to see it in movie theaters, just like I refuse to see Han Solo in movie
theaters. Oh,
you're
not going to
see... And I think it looks amazing. Like,
yeah,
the trailers that I've seen...
You got Childish Gambino.
Oh, man, he's going to steal the show, man. Yeah. I mean, he is going to be amazing. The trailer looks amazing. It really is something I do want to see, but... The only way that you can affect the bottom line is to affect the bottom line.
Yeah.
And that is not to give my money to Disney, to let them know that I am unsatisfied with what they have done to this franchise and where they continue to go with it. Because now we got to double down on it of Rian Johnson with a new trilogy coming out. So he makes a movie that divides the whole fan base in half. Go to Rotten Tomatoes. Look at it. It's got like a 42% audience approval score.
Wow.
And you're just going to give this man a trilogy and let him roll with it. One of the last points I do want to make about Last Jedi.
Yeah.
If this was not a saga film, I think I could like it.
Interesting.
But the fact that you went and crapped over 30 years of history
mm-hmm.
and just did whatever you want like you've never seen a Star Wars movie in your life is why I can't like this movie.
Right. And that really brings us into hyperspace and warp speed. We're talking here with Travis Thigpen. Travis, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I want to do this again. I want to talk more about Star Wars as we get onto this new... There's going to be another series on Disney Channel. There's going to be... Or is it on Disney Channel? What's it going to be on? Adult Swim?
No, next year, 2019, Disney is actually launching their streaming service.
Oh, it's going to be only online?
Only on their streaming service. They've already hired Jon Favreau.
Okay, I like Jon
Favreau.
To do
a live-action TV series, bringing in up-and-coming directors for, you know, much like the Arrow and the Flash shows and stuff like mm-hmm. that, where there's a different director for each episode, or maybe an arc or something like that. So maybe we could get our Dave Filoni there. And he could show Kathleen Kennedy that he needs to be in charge of the creative side.
Sure, sure. Well, Travis, this has all been extremely beneficial to me and informative to myself and our listeners. And we hope that you can come back on sometime and we can do more Sith and Synth.
I would love that. Thank you so much, Danny, for having me today.
Thank you, Travis. You're listening to Danny on Everything. Yeah.
We are back. Danny on Everything, our fifth ever episode, our April episode. I am so happy to have done this again back at the studio. Thank you, Carl Cerny. Thank you, John Deming. His new book, Headline News, is available at indolentbooks.com. And thank you again to Travis Thigpen. We did a great Sith and Synth. And we're going to do more. We're probably going to talk more about Marvel and other stuff that's coming up as well. 20th anniversary of Sweet Mother Child. I just have to say, so many amazing memories of that band. And we're going to leave you with one more little insert from the Sweet Mother Child album, who is Mr. Groovy Tunes. And it's called Documented Airwaves. And I figured that it was a pretty apropos little snippet to go with the airwaves of Danny on Everything. My name is Danny Bedrosian. Thank you. Come back. And also, before I leave, please support us at moosemagnificat.com. There's a place on the website where you can donate. Every donation helps. We're looking for sponsors actively right now. You can email me at info@dannybedrosian.com or email us at Moose Magnificat. All the information is right there. Go to www.moosemagnificat.com and you can contact myself or the fine people there. And let's talk. Let's talk about getting some sponsorship and getting some more support if you like shows like this and the kind of stuff we're doing. And I want to just keep coming back to you guys. And I really appreciate all the support and all the love. Thank you, everyone, again. My name is Danny Bedrosian. You have been listening to Danny on Everything.
This message of the last surviving Groove Monster isn't over. It shall continue to linger in the oxygen.